It's New Letters on the Air. Today, our Black History Month celebration continues with a look at Nikki Giovanni, a woman who burst onto the literary scene in the 1960s as a revolutionary poet, unafraid to explore blackness, womanhood, or sexuality. Stay with us as Nikki Giovanni talks about her life and work on this archive edition of New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam. Born in Knoxville, Tennessee, Yolanda Cornelia Giovanni Jr. was dubbed Nikki Rosa by her older sister. Though she was tied to Knoxville by her grandparents, her immediate family moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, where she was raised. You can find out much about the young Nikki in her essay collection, Gemini, an extended autobiographical statement on my first 25 years of being a black poet, a book that depicts her anger, enthusiasm, and humor. 30-plus years have elapsed since those revolutionary days. I caught up with Nikki Giovanni in the fall of 1997 to find out about her life in Blacksburg, Virginia, as a university professor, where she still teaches today. I asked her to fill in what her early work didn't tell me, such as, when did she realize that she was a writer?
I haven't read Gemini in a while, so I don't know what I said exactly in there. But I think that writing is an existential statement, and I say that all the time, say that to my students too. So it becomes, it's not that you ask an insignificant question, but it becomes an insignificant concept of when did you decide, because you have to choose writing every time you write. And so in other words, I would never be, for example, Ralph Ellison, who, and it's a very fine book, I don't have a problem with Invisible Man, but I could never have said to myself, oh, I wrote a book, so I'm a writer. I have to say I'm writing a book, so I'm a writer. And I try to say that to my students because I still think it's better to be wrong. I think it's better to make what anybody would call a mistake than to sit around and say, well, I used to do that, and I'm not going to do it anymore. I mean, God wrote one book. He's probably the last person that should, you know. All the rest of us should continue to put something out there. I think that that's kind of important.
Yeah. To keep it up, to call yourself a writer. Well, do you remember when you wrote your first poem? Or?
Oh, sure. I was in college practically. I mean, well, of course, you always write. My mother, and I'm always laughing about my mom, but my mother has boxes. You know, when you're in the fifth grade, she said, see, I knew you could write then. I said, Mother, you didn't know that. I mean, but she's my mother, and she likes me, and she thinks, I mean, all mothers think their kids are smart and stuff. So she kept it. But I think for me, I was in college, and I was enjoying doing it. But in all fairness to myself, there are several things that I actually enjoy. I like to clean. And maybe if I could have seen a way that I could have started Nikki's Cleaning Service, I would have gone into that and by now have divided the stock several times and been quite rich. But it didn't sort of work out. I like to write. I like to cook. And I like to play tennis. And of all of those things, the only one that offered any sort of ongoing relationship actually was writing. And actually, I do still play tennis, and I think if I hadn't been black, you know, or I guess I don't want to not have been black, but when I was coming up, black people couldn't make a career out of tennis. And I think if you had it to do all over again, of course, I smoked then too, so you had those kind of problems. I mean, what the hell do you know? You just do what you're doing and you get some sort of response and then you keep doing it. I do think that writing is a way of looking, though, a way of looking at the world, and I think that's important.
One of the nice things about having a whole life as a writer, and something that you stress, and I think one of the interviews I read, there's a book out that's called Conversations with Nikki Giovanni.
Yeah, edited by Virginia Fowler.
And it's really intriguing. I mean, you've got things in here that are... You talk with James Baldwin, you talk with Margaret Walker, just some wonderful people. And so some of the conversations that are recorded are actually quite contentious. I mean, you and Margaret really go at it.
Yeah, we're old friends, and both of us, Margaret, of course, is my mother's generation. She's born in 1915, and she and my mother actually know each other. But Margaret and I are friends. And what we did in this interview was to represent the views of our generation. I thought we did very well. Jimmy and I did also. I'm very fortunate, I think, in my age. It's kind of amazing when you think about the number of people that somebody like me had an opportunity to know simply because they were alive. I know Lena Horne, for example. And I've done an interview with her a long time ago. I did an interview with her. But I also know people like Endazaki Shange because they're the younger generations. So my generation had the great fortune of just coming at that point that everybody was still alive. people born 10 years later missed a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You know, you missed the people that knew Langston Hughes. And I did not know Mr. Hughes because he died the year before I got to New York. But I knew people that knew Mr. Hughes. I knew John Killens. I didn't know Lorraine Hansberry, but I knew a lot of people, including Nina Simone, who knew Lorraine.
Well, I hadn't really thought about that, but you're able to know people from early in the century through people.
Again, it's a question of, I was born in 1943, and the people between 40 and about 45, if you wanted to, you really could get to know everybody. I met Rosa Parks one day at the Philadelphia airport in the commuter terminal. And I sat down with a cup of coffee, and I was like, I don't feel like I'm going to sleep. And, you know, just your eyes wake. And I said, damn, that looks like Mrs. Parks. And I grabbed my bag, and I just went over, and a woman was sitting next to her. It was a traveler. I mean, I don't know who that person was. And I said, excuse me, do you need this seat? And she must have thought, you know, who the heck is this? And she looked up, she said, I said, can you move? And she said, well, yes. I said, thank you. I did, actually, a white male thing. Because you know how white men just take space? I just did that. And I just moved people away from her so that we sat there and talked until her plane came. You know, like, you know. And Ms. Parks, like I said, and again, it's Ms. Parks, I'm Nikki Giovanni. She said, I've read you, I know you. And I said, oh, it's such a pleasure. I mean, you know, we just sat there and talked until her plane came. I miss mine. And I thought, I can get the next plane, but I will never get Mrs. Parks to myself again. And so I just moved everybody out and talked to her. It was great. Yeah, it was great.
Did a poem come out of that?
No, that was a private meeting. I mean, I did a poem for her way before. It's in Night Winds,
right.
Way before I met her. I've actually done very little work on people I know. And I think that it's unfair once you really get to know people. I did a poem for Lena and Horn, and once I got to know her, because my son and her grandchildren are the same age and they start to play, then I would never write about her again. I won't write about her again. But you want people to know, because writers are terrible people, as you know. And one of the things we do know, I mean, that's why our families quake. You know, every time there's a family gathering, you can hear people, shh, Nikki's around, you know. But I don't mind I don't mind the family, you know, they're up for grabs. But I don't think it's fair to meet people and turn them into something.
I'm looking right now at a book that's actually a compilation. It's called Love Poems, but they're poems from throughout your career. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that it's 15 from previous books, and the rest are new. That book, Love Poems, I dedicated to Tupac Shakur. The reason that I did is that it broke my heart that young man was assassinated. And it was bad enough that he was assassinated, which reminded me of the Emmett Till case, that level of assassination, or Malcolm X when people shot him down. But that also people were just being so cruel that people were saying, well, he got what he deserved. And so I tried to think, what did Tupac Shakur ever do? What he tried to do was tell the truth as he saw it. So when does it become all right to kill somebody because you don't like what they have to say? And I didn't like that. I have a tattoo that says Thug Life. And I have it on my left arm because I thought, well, if we're killing thugs, then maybe we should all be thugs. I like to think if I lived in Europe in the 1930s, 1939, if they were making Jews wear black stars, I would have worn a black star because it's the same thing.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
there it is.
Yeah, because
and
it was the least
tiny
I could do.
Either.
No, it's a good size. I wanted to be able to share it because it's not right to kill people and then to act like they deserved it. How could he deserve it? And so Love Poems started out as one sort of expression, because I wanted to do a variety of themes on love. And so there's a poem from my son Thomas in there, because Thomas's first meat was lamb chops, and I remember his face. I wrote that little poem. It's a poem for my mother in there, too. But there's also a poem for the Million Man March, because I just thought it was so courageous for the people who actually went, because you didn't know until, you know, if you were in Kansas City, you were in St. Louis, Cincinnati, you did not know until you got to Washington, D.C., that you would not be the only person there. And I thought, we have to give you credit for what you've done. And I think black men are a wonder. I think that they do beautiful things. And I think that the press gets on their case because they're powerless to stop their image. People make an image out of them like they want to. I don't think it's right. And so I just wanted to salute the heroic brothers who tried to make a positive statement. I thought it was a wonderful thing to go to D.C., and I was very proud of them. So I have those kind of poems in there, too, because a lot of life and a lot of love is about heroics. I also have a poem to Edna Lewis, who was the foremost country cook in America. I mean, Edna Lewis is a marvel, because anybody who cooks food is about love. I just wanted love poems to look at love in all of its aspects. Yeah. There's also, you know, the pant poems, too, because it's always nice to pant.
Yeah, there are some very sensual poems in here. It's interesting that you mentioned both the Million Man March and the poem to Tupac Shakur, because I marked both of them. Yeah. Would you read one of them for us? Which one would you prefer to read?
Oh, I can read either one.
How about All Eyes on You?
Hey, yo. Are you afraid to die? Or do you want to live forever? Tell me, what's wrong?
All Eyes on You for Tupac Shakur. As I tossed and turned, unable to achieve sleep, unable to control anxiety, unable to comprehend why, Tupac is not with us. If those who lived by the sword died by the sword, there would be no white men on earth. If those who lived on hatred died on hatred, there would be no KKK. If those who lived by lies died by lies, there would be nobody on Wall Street, in executive suites, in academic offices instructing the young. Don't tell me he got what he deserved. He deserved a chariot and the accolades of a grateful people. He deserved his life. It is as clear as a mountain stream, as defining as a lightning strike, as terrifying as the son to vampires. Tupac told the truth. There were those who called it dirty, gangster rap, inciting. There were those who never wanted to be angry at the conditions, but angry at the messenger who reported, "Your kitchen has roaches. Your toilet is overflowing. Your basement has so much water the rats are in the living room. Your house is in disorder." And Tupac told you about it. What a beautiful boy. Graceful carriage, melodic voice, sharp wit, intellectual breath. What a beautiful boy to lose. Not me, never me. I do not believe East Coast, West Coast. I saw them murder Emmett Till. I saw them murder Malcolm X. I saw them murder Martin Luther King. I witnessed them shooting Rap Brown. I saw them beat Leroy Jones. I saw them fill their jails. I see them burning churches. Not me. Never me. I do not believe this is some sort of mouth action. This is some sort of political action, and they picked well. They picked the brightest, freshest fruit from the tallest tree. What a beautiful boy. But he will not go away. As Malcolm did not go away, as Emmett Till did not go away. Your shooting him will not take him from us. His spirit will fill our hearts. His courage will strengthen us for the challenge. His truth will straighten our backbones. You know, Socrates had a mother. She, too, watched her son drink hemlock. She, too, asked why. But Socrates stood firm and would not lie to save himself. Tupac has a mother. The lovely Afeni has to bury her son. It is not right. It is not right that this young warrior is cut down. It is not right for the old to bury the young. It is not right. This generation mourns Tupac as my generation mourned Till, as we all mourn Malcolm, this wonderful warrior. Sonia Sanchez said when she learned of his passing, she walked all day walking the beautiful warrior home to our ancestors. I just cried, as all mothers cry for the beautiful boy who said he and Mike Tyson would never be allowed to be free at the same time. Who told the truth about them, and who told the truth about us? Who is our beautiful warrior? There are those who wanted to make him the problem, who wanted to believe if they silenced Tupac, all would be quiet on the ghetto front. There are those who testified that the problem wasn't the conditions, but the people talking about them. They took away bands, so the boys started scratching. They took away gyms, so the boys started breakdancing. The boys started rapping because they gave them the guns and the drugs, but not the schools and libraries. What a beautiful boy to lose. And we mourn Tupac Shakur, and we reach out to his mother, and we hug ourselves in sadness and in shame, and we are compelled to ask, are you happy, Miss Tucker? Tupac is gone. Are you happy?
Nikki Giovanni reading All Eyes on You for Tupac Shakur. That's from her book entitled Love Poems, and it's published by Morrow.
If there would be a defining moment of the 60s, it was the death of Emmett Till. It gets underplayed a lot in the majority press, and as white people look at it, I think it's not an act that they recognize. They recognize Brown versus Topeka, and Brown was an important decision, there's no question, but the response to Brown was the murder of Emmett Till. And I think that the black community, if you looked at what galvanized us, it was that that child was so horribly killed. I don't know if he could have been nicely killed, but, you know, I don't want to, but it was just such a horrible situation that people started to mobilize. You realize 5 years later we were doing the Mississippi Project, that the whole 60s came out, and it had to be Mrs. Bradley Till's mother opened that casket. And people said, how can you do that? She said, I want the world to see what they did to my son. Well, we're going to come down to 1967, 68, and we're going to have everybody chanting, the whole world is watching you. And the Till situation was so crucial. And I look at the death of Tupac Shakur in the same way. Because for this generation, he's the first assassination of his generation. And it isn't a significant situation. It wasn't, let's just go and shoot somebody. They picked a particular person. He's one of the most charismatic, one of the brightest, one of the gentlest young men of his generation. Look at what he represented. And I think that time is going to prove me right. I don't have any question that time will prove me right. He's a great man.
How did your students feel about this? I know you're teaching now. Was there a big reaction? I mean, is this something you brought up in class?
Well, I don't read my poetry in class. I don't think it's enough that they have to be bothered with me. They don't have to deal with the work. But I teach at Virginia Tech, which is predominantly a white institution. And I think that probably we're all aware that the biggest purchasers of rap in terms of the numbers are white Americans. So we don't have that problem. I think that my students, in terms of us discussing the Tupac situation, my students, of course, are very sympathetic because they do all see themselves as Tupac Shakur, as my generation had to finally see ourselves, because the older generation just kills you. They just knock you down. They just trample on you, and it's not right. So in terms of my sympathy for Tupac, when I said to my class, I'm trying to decide what to do, because we were just, I'm trying to decide how to express it. And so one of my students, KC, said, well, why don't you write a poem? I said, well, KC, the poem is there. I don't have a poem problem. I just don't know what else, because it seems like I should do something else. And I decided, because KC, but I have a lot of students, girls and boys, who have tattoos. And I said, I think I'll get a tattoo. And they all said, oh, Mr. Wright, you're not going to get a tattoo. They mostly actually call me Nikki. He said, you're not going to get a tattoo. And I said, oh, I'm going to think about it for a minute. And I had to go someplace, and I was in, Blacksburg is about 40 miles from Roanoke. And I was in Roanoke, and I thought, well, okay, I've got a couple of hours. Let me just go check out. So I went to Alex's tattoo there, and I said, I like a tattoo that says Thug Life, because that's what my tattoo says, it's Thug Life. And he said, you don't look like a thug. And I said, oh, I'm a thug. We were laughing. But I did. He had to design it. It actually took him longer to design it, because it wasn't one of the things on the wall. And Tupac's tattoo says Thug Life, but he has a bullet. And I didn't want to do a bullet. I just wanted to do an identification. So
you've always been political. It's always been something that's part of your life, even though I think I read somewhere in here that you were saying, well, you're past that now in some essence. But obviously you're not. You can't you can't separate your life from that, can you? I mean,
I was going to say, I just think there's always something going on. You know, and every time you say to yourself, well, it's kind of settled, or we got that put away. It doesn't work that way. It keeps coming back. But I'm not ideological. I am political, but I'm not ideological. And to me, it's just, I like human beings. I do always recommend us.
That is something that I noticed about your work, is that there is this, well, of course, reading love poems, you can't help but see it, but there is this love of
yeah.
people.
People are wonderful. I mean, as I say, we're not nice and stuff. I'm not going to say that, but we're wonderful.
There's a poem that I think shows your love for other human beings. It's for Teresa.
Oh, sure.
And it's short. I was wondering if you'd read that for us.
Sure. And when I was all alone facing my adolescence, looking forward to cleaning house and reading books and maybe learning bridge so that I could fit into acceptable society acceptably, you came along and loved me for being black and bitchy and hateful and scared. And you came along and cared that I got all the things necessary to adulthood, and even made sure that I wouldn't hate my mother or father. And you even understood that I should love Peppy, but not too much, and give to Gary, but not all of me, and keep on moving till I found me. And now you're sick and have been hurt for some time, and I felt guilty and impotent for not being able to give yourself to you as you gave yourself to me.
For Teresa. That's Nikki Giovanni, and that's from the book Love Poems, and you're listening to New Letters on the Air. Who was Teresa?
She was a friend of my mother's. She has since died. She had a stroke, but we grew up with Teresa. She was like my mother's oldest friend. They knew each other like 50 years. She's been in the family longer than I was.
Wow.
In fact, they were very close, and a dear friend, a wonderful
Yeah.
Wonderful woman.
You can tell that you cared so much for
her.
Oh,
yeah. She's my friend. She could cook, too. We used to cook together. And I'm a good cook, and my grandmother's a good cook. And it's only been lately, and I do admit it, that I recognize my mother as being a good cook, because mother's cooking was so different from the rest of us. But all of us used to get together and cook, and Teresa loved to eat. And so it's always fun, you know, smoked fish. We learned to do a lot of things together, just great fun. I came home one day. My father had a cancer and died. And it's a lot to do with Cincinnati, but he didn't die right away. He didn't have a cancer and die the next week, but
he had a stroke earlier.
He had a stroke.
And that took you home. I found that very touching, that you took your life, you pulled up your son and yourself out of New York City and moved back to Cincinnati to basically help take care of your parents.
Well, sure. My son paid me a compliment. I really like Thomas, and I've always felt very fortunate in that I have, I think, a really wonderful son. And he said, you know what I learned from you? You know how you're talking to your kid. And he said, you know what I learned from you? And I was thinking, I didn't think you learned anything from me. I said, what, Thomas? He said that you just do what needs to be done. You don't ask about it. And I said, oh, what makes you, how did this come up? And he said, I remember, because he was, 10? He said, I remember when grandfather got sick and you said, we're moving. And he said, I didn't, you know, I couldn't deal with it at that point. He said, I didn't know what you were doing. But as I've gotten older, he said, I've watched you. You never ask. You just do what you think needs to be done. And he has a friend who had an accident. And he said, and I just went to help her. He said, I found myself just doing you. I said, well, and I was totally pleased to think that I did something that he approved of. That, you know, because you're always hoping your kids like you.
Now, you do teach. Do you love it? Is it something you adore as much as anything in your life?
I do. You know, I had a cancerous tumor. That's one of the reasons I have a hard time walking up steps.
No, I did not know
that. That was quite a feat that I did this morning. I'm very proud of myself. And it was a lung tumor, so they took it out. And they took out, of course, the lung and two ribs. And so the last couple of years, I've been recovering. And I'm very fortunate to be recovering, because lung tumors, the fatality rate is real high. So I'm really very fortunate to, you know, be alive. For the first time since, actually, probably a year before I was even diagnosed with it, because I was sick and didn't realize why, I'm really feeling like my, as it were, my old self. I'm really feeling pretty good. I don't have pain, you know, like my back doesn't hurt. And because, you know, when they do a lung operation, they cut your back.
Yeah.
And I don't, well, you always think of your lungs as being in the front.
In the front, but
you actually
really
go through
the back.
Uh-huh. But I'm feeling like so much better. And so teaching is back to being what it was always to me, which is fun. I like kids, and I like ideas, and I like arguments, I like talking, you know, all of the things you can see probably pretty much what I enjoy doing. And so teaching is fun. Because you worry. With cancer, you do worry. And anybody says other things, it's just not being candid. You do worry. But I've reached a point where I'm statistically back to the same chance of dying of cancer as if I had never had cancer. So I can't ask for a better deal. This is the best it's going to get for me. And I'm more than content that this is the situation. And so, you know, you try to take care of yourself and you try to go along. But this is really, I'm having a really good year, because I feel really good for the first time in a long time. So I'm really pleased about that.
You know, there's something about your whole optimistic spirit that comes through, I think, not only in your work, but certainly in your presence. And I can't help but think that has something to do with your healing.
Well, I think I got lucky. I mean, I don't think that can be overlooked. And I think that prayers help. I think that it helps that people sent me a lot of good wishes, and you know, you want to live, and so you just try to give yourself the best chance. And I'm writing a book about my experience with this tumor. But the one thing that I think is important for anybody who might even be listening, if you think something's wrong, it is. You should, you know, really thoroughly have it checked out and keep looking, because something is. And I think that it was important to me not to whine. I try to be a really good patient. I try to do what I was told. Since I don't know anything about cancer, I know a lot about a lot, but I didn't know anything about cancer. I just know that it potentially is a killer, and I didn't want to die with a tumor in me. That I did know, and I said that to my doctor. Now, whatever might happen, the tumor cannot stay in me. One of us has to take it out. Now, I would prefer a surgeon, but I will cut my chest open before I let this tumor stay in me, because I think I have a right not to have an intruder in my body. I can't do anything about the death, but I can do something about what's with me when I die. And I had strong feelings about that. So I'm just very fortunate, and I'm very happy. You know, somebody said, well, did it change the way you look at the world? I said, really, it didn't. And that's what you really hope, is that you're looking at the world. I hope that I'm at the top of my game, is what I'm saying. I hope that, my vision doesn't take a trauma in order for me to appreciate life. I appreciated life before I had a tumor.
I think that comes across. Yeah, I think you've always appreciated life.
Yeah, I don't dislike people who don't learn from trauma. But I don't think that I'm a person, you know, I can read the handwriting on the wall. I don't have to get knocked on the head, too. And so I think that it's important for all of us to recognize it's a precious transitory situation here, and we may as well do the best we can. Since we're all in this gene pool, we may as well try to lift human beings a little bit. We can do that, you know, and I think we all are benefited by good wishes, by good humor, by trying to make things a little better.
One of the things that you've done most recently, they've taken one of your poems and made it into a children's book.
Yeah.
And it's very delightful. It's fun to look at. And
Chris Raschke is one of my all-time favorites. Yeah.
And the drawings are wonderful.
Yeah, he did a great job. He really did.
What made them do this? I mean, what made them take this particular one?
I don't have
one?
A clue.
Yeah. And I don't, somebody just picked it out and said,
Mark Aronson wanted it, and he called me, and it was like, yeah, because I just say yes, because yes works, you know. And he said, well, do you have any ideas who might illustrate it? And I'm a big fan of Chris Raschke because of a children's book called Charlie Parker Plays Bebop. And I love that. And I thought, well, can I have Chris Raschke? And Mark said to me, well, you know, he doesn't work with anybody else, so I think he'll probably say no. And I said, well, Mark, because at that point I was like 52. I said, I've heard no before. But I do know that it would be wrong not to ask. So, you know, your job is to ask. Chris's job is to say no. And then your job is to come back to me and say, I told you so. And then we'll go on. So he called Chris's people, and Chris considered it and did say yes. And he come back and said, Chris said yes. I said, yeah, yeah. So, but I love Chris's work. And it was right to ask because, I mean, it's like, you know, asking Toni Morrison to contribute to Grandmothers or something. You have to ask. You have to ask the best, and they say no, and then you go on. But you have to ask.
Or sometimes they say yes.
And in case of Chris, they did. And so he did the little genie. This is for Nina Simone. Because, you know, the fairy tales, the princess is always pricking her finger and going to sleep. And I didn't want Nina to prick her finger. I wanted her to stay around forever. Take a note and spin it around, spin it around. Don't prick your finger. Take a note and spin it around on the black loom, on the black loom. Careful, baby, don't prick your finger. Take the air and weave the sky around the black loom, around the black loom. Make the sky sing a black song, sing a blue song, sing my song. Make the sky sing a black song from the black loom, from the black loom. Careful, baby, don't prick your finger. Take the genie and put her in a jar, put her in a jar. Wrap the sky around her. Take the genie, put her in a jar, wrap the sky around her, listen to her sing. Sing a black song, our black song, from the black loom, singing to me from the black loom. Careful, baby, don't prick your finger.
Nikki Giovanni, reading her poem, The Genie in the Jar, now available as a children's book. Her new books include The Collected Poetry of Nikki Giovanni, containing some of the work you heard today, and The Prosaic Soul of Nikki Giovanni, both published in 2003. This 1997 recording is available for purchase, along with the rest of our archives, which you can see on our website, www.newletters.org. For more information, call toll-free 888-548-2477 or email ontheair@newletters.org. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters, the quarterly magazine of fine writing published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This show was originally produced with help from Laura Spencer. Thanks also to Alex Smith and Dennis Conroe. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.